until the pile of limestone shifted. A few times, I had watched Samira emerge from beneath her camouflage hijab. It would look like she had stepped out of a tree trunk, or a plain white wall, or the display case at a Dunkin' Donuts. This sight gave me a similar kind of vertigo. My mind had to reprocess what I was looking at. Not a section of ruined wall, but a giant 20 feet tall, whose appearance perfectly mimicked limestone. His rough brown and beige skin was beaded like a Gila monster's. A flocking of rubble crusted his long, shaggy hair and beard. He wore a tunic and leggings of quilted heavy canvas, giving him that fortress wall look. Why he'd been leaning against the grocery store, I had no idea. Dozing? Panhandling? Did giants panhandle? He fixed us with his amber eyes, the only part of him that seemed truly alive.
"Well, well," rumbled the giant. "I've been waiting ages for Vikings to appear at the Viking Center. Can't wait to kill you."
"Good idea, Alex," I squeaked. "Let's follow the signs to the Viking Center. Yay." For once, she had no scathing comeback. She stared at the giant, her mouth hanging open, her raincoat hood slipping back from her head. TJ's rifle quivered in his hands like a dowsing rod. I didn't feel much braver. Sure, I'd seen taller giants. I'd seen eagle giants, fire giants, drunk giants, and giants in gaudy bowling shirts. But I'd never had a stone giant appear right in front of me and cheerfully offer to kill me. Standing upright, his shoulders were level with the two-story rooftops around us. The few pedestrians on the streets simply walked around him as if he were an inconvenient construction project. He grabbed the nearest telephone pole and yanked it out of the ground along with a large circular chunk of pavement. Only when he rested the pole across his shoulder did I realize it was his weapon. A maul with a head the size of a hot tub.
"Vikings used to be more social," he rumbled. "I thought surely they'd come to their community center for trials by combat. Or at least for bingo. But you're the first ones I've seen in..."
He tilted his shaggy head, a gesture that looked like an avalanche of sheepdogs.
"How long was I sitting there? I must have dozed off. Ah, well. Tell me your names, warriors. I would like to know who I am killing."
At that point, I would have screamed, "I claim guest rights." But sadly, we were not inside the giant's home. I doubted guest rights would apply on a public street in a human city. "Are you the giant Hrungnir?" I asked, hoping I sounded more confident than panic-stricken. "I'm Magnus Chase. This is Thomas Jefferson Jr. and Alex Fierro. We're here to bargain with you." The shaggy stone colossus looked from side to side.
"Of course I am Hrungnir. Do you see any other giants around? I'm afraid killing you is non-negotiable, little Inherye. But we can haggle about the details if you like."
I gulped. "How did you know we're in Harjar?" Hrungnir grinned, his teeth like the crenellations of a castle turret.
"You smell like in Harjar. Now come. What were you hoping to bargain for? A quick death? A death by squeezing? Perhaps a lovely death by stomping, followed by being scraped off the bottom of my shoe?"
I glanced at TJ, who shook his head vigorously like, "Not the shoe." Alex still hadn't moved. I only knew she was still alive because she blinked the rain out of her eyes.
"Oh, large and beige Hrungnir," I said. "We seek the location of Kvasir's mead."
Hrungnir scowled, his rocky eyebrows furrowing, his brick-like lips forming a segmental arch.
"Well, well. Playing Odin's thievery game, are you? The old Bulwark trick?
Maybe. Hrungnir chuckled.
I could give you that information. I was with Bogi and Suttung when they sequestered the mead in its new hiding place.
Right, I silently added Bogi and Suttung to my mental list of things I am clueless about. That's what we have come to bargain for. The location of the mead. I realized I had already said that. What is your price, O Beige One? Hrungnir stroked his beard, causing rubble and dust to sift down the front of his tunic.
For me to consider such a trade, your deaths would have to be very entertaining.
He studied TJ, then me. His eyes came to rest on Alex Fierro.
Ah, this one smells of clay. You have the necessary skills, do you not?
I glanced at Alex. Necessary skills? Eep, Alex said.
Excellent! Hrungnir boomed. It's been centuries since the Stone Giants found a worthy opponent for a traditional two-on-two duel. A fight to the death. Shall we say tomorrow at dawn?
Whoa, I said. Couldn't we do a healing contest? Or bingo, TJ offered. Bingo was good.
No, Hrungnir cried. My very name means brawler, little Inher Yi. You won't cheat me out of a good fight. We will follow the ancient rules of combat. Me versus...
I didn't want to volunteer, but I'd seen Jack take down bigger giants than this guy before. I raised my hand. Very well.
No, you're too scrawny.
Hrungnir pointed to TJ.
I challenge him!
I accept, TJ yelled. Then he blinked as if thinking, thanks a lot, Dad.
Good, good, the giant said. And my second will fight your second, who will be made by her.
Alex staggered back as if she'd been pushed. I can't. I've never...
Or I can just kill all three of you now, Hrungnir said. Then you'll have no chance of finding Kvasir's mead.
My mouth felt as dusty as the giant's beard. Alex, what's he talking about? What are you supposed to make? By the trapped look in her eyes, I could tell she understood Hrungnir's demand. I'd only seen her this panicked once before, on her first day in Valhalla, when she thought she might be stuck in one gender for the rest of eternity. She licked her lips. All right, I'll do it.
That's the spirit, Hrungnir said. As for the little blonde guy here, I guess he can be your water boy or something. Well, I'm off to make my second. You should do the same. I will meet you tomorrow, at dawn, at Konungsgirtha.
The giant turned and strode through the streets of York, pedestrians moving out of his way as if he were a veering bus. I turned to Alex. Explain? What did you just agree to? The contrast between her heterochromatic eyes seemed even greater than usual, as if the gold and the brown were separating, pooling to the left and right. We need to find a pottery studio, she said. Fast. Chapter 18. I roll Play-Doh to the death. You don't hear heroes say that a lot. Quick, boy wonder, to the pottery studio. But Alex's tone left no doubt it was a matter of life and death. The nearest ceramics workshop, a place called the Earthery, turned out to be on my favorite street, the Shambles. I didn't see that as a good omen. While TJ and I waited outside, Alex spent a few minutes talking with the proprietor, who at last emerged, grinning and holding a large wad of multicolored money. "Have fun, lads," he said as he hurried down the street. "Brilliant! Ta!" "Thank you," TJ waved. "And thanks for not getting involved in our civil war." We headed inside, where Alex was taking inventory. Work tables, potter's wheels, metal shelves lined with half-finished pots, tubs filled with tools, a cabinet stacked with slabs of wet clay and plastic bags. In the back of the studio, one door led to a small bathroom, another to what looked like a storage room. "This might work," Alex muttered. "Maybe." "Did you buy this place?" I asked. "Don't be silly. I just paid the owner for 24 hours exclusive use. But I paid well." "In British pounds," I noted. "Where'd you get so much local cash?" She shrugged, her attention on counting bags of clay. "It's called preparation, Chase. I figured we'd be traveling to the UK and Scandinavia. I brought euros, kronor, kroner, and pounds. Compliments of my family. And by compliments, I mean I stole it." I remembered my dream of Alex in front of her house, the way she'd snarled, "I don't want your money." Maybe she'd meant she only wanted it on her terms. I could respect that. But how she'd gotten so many different currencies, I couldn't guess. "Stop gopping and help me," she ordered. I wasn't gopping. "We need to push these tables together," she said. "TJ, go see if there's more clay in the back. We need a lot more." "On it." TJ dashed to the supply room. Alex and I moved four tables together, making a work surface big enough to play ping pong on. TJ hauled out extra bags of clay until I estimated we had an adequate amount to make a ceramic Volkswagen. Alex looked back and forth between the clay and the potter's wheels. She tapped her thumbnail nervously against her teeth. "Not enough time," she muttered. "Drying, glazing, firing." "Alex," I said, "if you want us to help you, you're going to have to explain what we're doing." TJ edged away from me, in case Alex brought out the garrote. She just glared at me. "You would know what I'm doing if you'd taken Pottery 101 in Valhalla with me like I asked you." I had a scheduling conflict. In fact, I hadn't liked the idea of pottery to the death, especially if it involved getting thrown in a fiery kiln. "Stone giants have a tradition called Tvervigi," said Alex. "Double combat."
"It's like Viking single combat, Einvigi," TJ added. "Except Tver instead of Ein."
"Fascinating," I said.
"I know. I read about it in..."
"Please don't say a travel guide." TJ looked at the floor. Alex picked up a box of assorted wooden tools. "Honestly, Chase, we don't have time to bring you up to speed. TJ fights Hrungnir. I make a ceramic warrior who fights the giant's ceramic warrior. You play water boy, or heel, or whatever. It's pretty straightforward." I stared at the bags of clay. "A ceramic warrior? As in magic pottery?" "Pottery 101, Alex repeated, like that was obvious. "TJ, would you start cutting those slabs? I need slices 1 inch thick, about 60 or 70 of them."
"Sure. Do I get to use your garrote?"
Alex laughed long and hard.
"Absolutely not. There should be a cutter in that gray tub."
TJ sulked off to find a regular clay cutter. "And you," Alex told me, "you're going to be making coils." "Coils. I know you can roll clay into coils. It's just like making snakes out of Play-Doh." I wondered how she knew my dark secret, that I had enjoyed Play-Doh as a kid. And when I say kid, I mean up to, like, age 11. I grudgingly admitted that this was within my scope of talents.
"And you?"
The hardest part is using the wheel, she said. The most important components have to be thrown. By thrown, I knew she meant shaped on the wheel, not thrown across the room, though with Alex, the two activities often went together. All right, boys, she said. Let's get to work. After a few hours spent rolling coils, my shoulders ached. My shirt stuck to my sweaty skin. When I closed my eyes, clay snakes flopped around on the backs of my eyelids. My only relief was getting up to change the station on the proprietor's little radio whenever Alex or TJ didn't like a song. TJ preferred martial music, but English radio had a shocking lack of marching band tunes. Alex favored songs from Japanese anime, also in short supply on the AM-FM dial. Finally, they both settled on Duran Duran, for reasons I can't explain. From time to time, I brought Alex soft drinks from the proprietor's mini-fridge. Her favorite was Tizer, a sort of cherry soda with extra twang. I didn't like it, but Alex quickly got addicted. Her lips turned bright red like a vampire's, which I found both disturbing and strangely fascinating. Meanwhile, TJ ran back and forth between his slab cutting and the kiln, which was heating up for an epic day of firing. He seemed to take special pleasure in poking pencil stub-sized dents in the slabs so they wouldn't crack when baked. He did this while humming Hungry Like the Wolf. Not my favorite song, given my personal history. TJ seemed cheerful for a guy who had a duel scheduled with a 20-foot-tall stone giant in the morning. I decided not to remind him that if he died here in England, he would stay dead, no matter how friendly the locals were. I had placed my work table as close as I could to Alex's wheel so I could talk to her. Usually, I waited to ask her a question until she was centering a new lump of clay. With both her hands engaged, she was less likely to hit me. "Have you done this before?" I asked. "Made a pottery guy?" She glanced over, her face flecked with white porcelain. "Tried a few times. Nothing this big. But my family..." She bore down on the clay, molding it into a beehive-like cone. "Like Hrungnir said, we have the necessary skills." "Your family?" I tried to imagine Loki sitting at a table, rolling clay snakes. "The Fieros." Alex shot me a wary look. "You really don't know? Never heard of Fiero Ceramics?"
Should I have?"
She smiled, as if she found my ignorance refreshing. "If you knew anything about cooking or home decor, maybe. It was a hot brand about 10 years ago. But that's fine. I'm not talking about the machine-made crap my dad sells anyway. I'm talking about my grandfather's art. He started the business when he emigrated from Tlatilco." "Tlatilco." I tried to place the name. "I'm guessing that's outside I-95? Alex laughed. "No reason you'd have heard of it. Tiny place in Mexico. These days, it's really just a subsection of Mexico City. According to my grandfather, our family has been making pottery there since before the Aztecs. Tlatilco used to be this super ancient culture." She pressed her thumbs into the center of her beehive, opening up the sides of the new pot. It still seemed like magic to me the way she did it, shaping such a delicate and perfectly symmetrical vase with nothing but strength and spin. The few times I'd tried to use a wheel, I'd nearly broken my fingers and managed to turn a lump of clay into a slightly uglier lump of clay. "Who knows what's true?" Alex continued. "These are just family stories, legends. But my abuelo took them seriously. When he moved to Boston, he kept doing things the old way. Even if he was just making a plate or a cup, he'd create every piece by hand, with lots of pride and attention to detail." "Blitzen were like that." Alex sat back, regarding her pot. "Yeah, my granddad would have made a good dwarf. Then my dad took over the business and decided to go commercial, He sold out. He mass-produced lines of ceramic dishware, entered into deals with home furnishing supply chains. He made millions before people started realizing the quality was going downhill. I recalled her father's bitter words in my dream. You had so much potential. You understood the craft almost as well as your grandfather. He wanted you to carry on the family business. She studied me, no doubt wondering how I'd guessed. I almost told her about the dream, but Alex really did not like having people inside her head, even unintentionally, and I didn't like being yelled at. My father is an idiot, she said. He didn't understand how I could like pottery but not want to make money off it. He definitely didn't appreciate me listening to my granddad's crazy ideas. Such as... Over at his work table, TJ kept poking holes in the clay slices with a dowel, creating different patterns, like stars and spirals. This is kind of fun, he admitted. Therapeutic. Alex's Tizer red lips curled up at the edges. My abuelo made pottery for a living, but his real interest was in our ancestors' sculptures. He wanted to understand the spirituality of them. That wasn't easy. I mean, after so many centuries, trying to figure out your heritage when it's been buried under so much else. Olmec, Aztec, Spanish, Mexican. How do you even know what's true? How do you reclaim it? I got the feeling her questions were rhetorical and didn't require answers from me, which was just as well. I couldn't think clearly with TJ humming Rio and dowling smiley faces in his clay. But your granddad managed, I guessed. He thought so. Alex spun up the wheel again, sponging the sides of her pot. So did I. My dad. Her expression soured. Well, he liked to blame, you know, the way I am, on Loki. He didn't like it at all when I found validation on the Fierro side of the family. My brain felt like my hands, as if a layer of clay was tightening over it, sucking out all the moisture. Sorry, I don't understand. What does this have to do with magic ceramic warriors? You'll see. Fish the phone out of my pocket and call Sam, will you? Give her an update. Then shut up so I can concentrate. Even under orders, pulling something out of Alex's pants pocket while she was wearing said pants seemed like a good way to get myself killed. I managed, with only a couple of small panic attacks, and found that Alex's phone had data service in the UK. She must have arranged that when she arranged her multi-currency theft. I texted Samira and gave her the lowdown. A few minutes later, the phone buzzed with her reply. K. GL. Fighting. GTG. I wondered if GTG in this context meant got to go, Gunderson throttling girlfriend, or giants torturing Gunderson. I decided to think optimistically and went with the first option. As the afternoon wore on, the back tables filled up with fired porcelain squares that looked like armored plates. Alex taught me how, by combining my coils, to form cylinders that would serve as arms and legs. Her efforts at the pottery wheel produced feet, hands, and a head, all shaped like vases and meticulously decorated with Viking runes. She spent hours on the faces, two of them, side by side, like the piece of art that Alex's father had shattered in my dream. The left face had heavy-lidded, suspicious eyes, a cartoon villain's curly mustache, and a huge, grimacing mouth. The right face was a grinning skull with hollow eye holes and a lolling tongue. Looking at the two visages pressed together, I couldn't help thinking about Alex's own different colored eyes. By evening, we'd laid out all the pieces of the ceramic warrior on our quadruple table, creating an 8-foot-long Frankenstein's monster. Some assembly required. Well, TJ wiped his forehead. That thing would scare me if I had to face it in battle. Agreed, I said. And speaking of faces... It's a duality mask, Alex explained. My ancestors from Tlatilco, they made a lot of the figurines with two faces, or one face with two halves. Nobody's sure why. My grandfather thought they represented two spirits in a single body.
Like my old Lenape friend Mother William, TJ said. So I guess the native cultures down in Mexico had Augur too.
He corrected himself quickly. I mean trans folks, gender-fluid folks. Augur, the Viking word for someone of shifting gender, literally meant unmanly, which was not an Alex-approved term. I studied the mask. No wonder the duality art spoke to you. Your granddad, he got who you were.
He got it,
Alex agreed. And he honored it. When he died, my dad did his best to discredit my abuelo's ideas, destroy his art, and turn me into a good little business person. I wouldn't let him. She rubbed the nape of her neck, maybe subconsciously touching the tattooed symbol of the figure-eight serpents. She had embraced shapeshifting, refusing to let Loki ruin it for her. She had done the same with pottery, even though her father had turned the family business into something she despised. Alex, I said, the more I find out about you, the more I admire you. Her expression was a mix of amusement and exasperation, like I was a cute puppy that had just peed on the carpet.
Hold the admiration until I can bring this thing to life, smooth talker. That's the real trick. In the meantime, we all need some fresh air.
She threw me another wad of money.
Let's go get some dinner. You're buying.
Chapter 19. I attend a zombie pep rally. Dinner was fish and chips at a place called Mr. Chippy. TJ found the name hilarious. While we ate, he kept saying, Mr. Chippy, in a loud, bubbly voice, which did not amuse the guy at the register. Afterward, we returned to the pottery studio to lay low for the night. TJ suggested going back to the ship to be with the rest of the crew, but Alex insisted she needed to keep an eye on her ceramic warrior. She texted Sam an update. Sam's response? NP. Okay, here. Fighting water horses. Fighting water horses was written in emojis. Fist, wave, horse. I guessed Sam had fought so many of them today she'd decided to make a text shortcut.
You got her international coverage too, I noted.
Well, yeah, Alex said. Gotta keep in touch with my sister. I wanted to ask why she hadn't done the same for me. Then I remembered I didn't have a phone. Most in Harryar didn't bother with them. For one thing, getting a number and paying the bill is hard when you're officially dead. Also, no data plan covers the rest of the nine worlds. And the reception in Valhalla is horrible. I blame the roof of Golden Shields. Despite all that, Alex insisted on keeping a phone. How she managed, I didn't know. Maybe Samira had registered her in some kind of friends and family, and also dead family program. As soon as we reached the studio, Alex checked on her ceramic project. I wasn't sure whether to be relieved or disappointed that it hadn't assembled itself and come to life yet.
I'll check it again in a few hours, she said. Gonna...
She staggered to the only comfy chair in the room, the proprietor's clay-spattered Barca lounger, then passed out and began to snore. Yikes, she could snore. TJ and I decided to bunk in the storage room, where we'd be better insulated from Alex's impression of a dying lawnmower. We made some impromptu mattresses out of canvas tarps. TJ cleaned his rifle and sharpened his bayonet. A nighttime ritual for him. I lay down and watched the rain patter against the skylights. The glass leaked, dripping on the metal shelves and filling the room with the smell of damp rust,
but I didn't mind. I was grateful for the steady drumming. "So, what happens tomorrow?" I asked TJ. "I mean, exactly." TJ laughed. "Exactly. I fight a 20-foot-tall giant until one of us dies or can't fight anymore. Meanwhile, the giant's clay warrior fights Alex's clay warrior until one of them is rubble. Alex, I don't know, cheers on her creation, I guess. You heal me if you can." "That's allowed?" TJ shrugged. "Far as I know, anything's allowed for you and Alex as long as you don't actually fight. Doesn't it bother you that your opponent is 15 feet taller than you?" TJ straightened his back. "Do you think I look that short? I'm almost 6 feet. How can you be so calm?" He inspected the edge of his bayonet, holding it up to his face so it seemed to cut him in half like a duality mask. "I've already beat the odds so many times, Magnus. On James Island, South Carolina, I was standing right next to a friend of mine, Joe Wilson, when a Reb sniper..." He made a finger gun and pulled the trigger. "Could have been me. Could have been any of us. I hit the dirt, rolled over, and stared up at the sky, and this sense of calm washed over me. I wasn't afraid anymore." "Yeah, that's called shock." He shook his head. "Nah, I saw Valkyries, Magnus. Ladies on horses, swirling in the skies above our regiment. I finally believed what my ma had always told me about my dad being Tyr. Those crazy stories about Norse gods in Boston. Right then I decided, okay, what happens, happens. If my dad is the god of bravery, I'd better make him proud." I wasn't sure that would have been my reaction. I was glad I had a father who was proud of me for healing people, enjoying the outdoors, and tolerating his talking sword. "You've met your dad?" I asked. "He gave you that bayonet, right?" TJ folded the blade in his chamois cloth like he was tucking it into bed. "The bayonet was waiting for me when I checked into Valhalla. I never met Tyr face to face." TJ shrugged. "Still, every time I accept a challenge, I feel closer to him. The more dangerous, the better." "You must feel super close to him right now," I guessed. TJ grinned. "Yep. Good times." I wondered how a god could go 150 years without acknowledging a son as brave as TJ, but my friend wasn't alone. I knew a lot of Inheriar who had never met their parents. FaceTime with the kids wasn't a priority for Norse deities, maybe because they had hundreds or thousands of children, or maybe because the gods were jerks. TJ lay back on his tarp mattress. "Now I just gotta figure out how to kill that giant. I'm worried a direct frontal charge might not work." For a Civil War soldier, this was creative thinking. "So what's your plan?" I asked. "No idea." He tipped his Union cap over his eyes. "Maybe something will come to me in my dreams. Night, Magnus." He began to snore almost as loudly as Alex. I couldn't win. I lay awake, wondering how Sam, Halfborn, and Mallory were doing on board the ship. I wondered why Blitzen and Hearthstone weren't back yet, and why it would take them 5 days just to scout the location of a whetstone. Niord had promised I'd see them again before the really dangerous stuff went down. I should have gotten him to swear an oath on his immaculately groomed feet. Mainly, though, I worried about my own impending duel with Loki, a contest of insults with the most eloquent Norse deity. What had I been thinking? No matter how magical Kvasir's mead was, how could it possibly help me beat Loki at his own game? No pressure, of course. If I lost, I'd just be reduced to a shadow of myself, and imprisoned in Helheim while all my friends died and Ragnarok destroyed the 9 worlds. Maybe I could buy a book of Viking insults at the Viking Center gift shop. TJ snored on. I admired his courage and positivity. I wondered if I'd have a tenth of his presence of mind when I had to face Loki. My conscience answered,
No, then broke down in hysterical sobbing. Thanks to the rain, I finally managed to sleep. But my dreams were not relaxing, nor were they reassuring. I found myself back on Naglfar, the ship of the dead. Masses of draugr swarmed the deck, rags and mildewed armor hanging from their bodies, their spears and swords corroded like burnt matchsticks. The warriors' spirits fluttered inside their ribcages, like blue flames clinging to the last remnants of kindling. Thousands upon thousands shambled toward the foredeck, where hand-painted banners hung along the rails and waved from the yardarms in the frigid wind. Make some noise! Go, draugr, go! Ragnarok and roll! And other slogans so terrible they could only have been written by the dishonored dead. I did not see Loki, but standing at the helm, on a dais cobbled together from dead men's nails, was a giant so old I almost thought he might be one of the undead. I'd never seen him before, but I'd heard stories about him. Hrym, the captain of the ship. His very name meant decrepit. His bare arms were painfully emaciated. Wisps of white hair clung to his leathery head like icicles, making me think of pictures I'd seen of prehistoric men found in melting glaciers. Moldy white furs covered his wasted frame. His pale blue eyes, though, were very much alive. He couldn't have been as frail as he looked. In one hand, he brandished a battle axe bigger than I was. In the other hand was a shield made from the sternum of some huge animal, the space between the ribs fitted with sheets of studded iron.
Soldiers of Helheim, the giant bellowed. Behold!
He gestured across the gray water. At the other end of the bay, the glacial cliffs crumbled more rapidly, ice cracking and sloughing into the sea with a sound like distant artillery.
The way will soon be clear,
the giant shouted.
Then we sail to battle. Death to the gods!
The cry went up all around me, hollow, hateful voices of the long dead taking up the chant. Mercifully, my dream shifted. I stood in a recently plowed wheat field on a warm, sunny day. In the distance, wildflowers blanketed rolling hills. Beyond that, milk-white waterfalls tumbled down the sides of picturesque mountains. Some part of my brain thought, at last, a pleasant dream. I'm in a commercial for organic whole wheat bread. Then an old man in blue robes hobbled toward me. His clothes were tattered and mud-stained from long travel. His wide-brimmed hat shaded his face, though I could make out his graying beard and secretive smile. When he reached me, he looked up, revealing one eye that gleamed with malicious humor. The other eye socket was dark and empty.
I am Bolverk, he said, though of course I knew it was Odin.
Aside from his less-than-creative disguise, once you've heard Odin give a keynote address on best berserker practices, you never forget his voice.
I'm here to make you the deal of a lifetime.
From beneath his cloak, he produced an object the size of a cheese round, covered in cloth. I was afraid it might be one of Odin's inspirational CD collections. Then he unwrapped it, revealing a circular whetstone of gray quartz. It reminded me of the bashing end of Hrungnir's maul, only smaller and less maul-worthy. Odin Bolverk offered it to me.
Will you pay the price?
Suddenly, Odin was gone. Before me loomed a face so large I couldn't take it all in. Glowing green eyes with vertical slits for pupils, leathery nostrils dripping with mucus. The stench of acid and rotten meat burned my lungs. The creature's maw opened to reveal rows of jagged, triangular teeth ready to shred me, and I sat bolt upright, screaming in my bed of tarps. Above me, dim gray light filtered through the skylights.
The rain had stopped. TJ sat across from me, munching a bagel, a strange pair of glasses on his face. Each lens had a clear center, bordered by a ring of amber glass, making TJ look like he'd acquired a second set of irises.
"Finally up," he noted. "Bad dreams, huh?"
My whole body felt jittery, like coins rattling inside a change separator machine.
What's going on?" I asked. "What's with the glasses?"
Alex Fierro appeared in the doorway.
"A scream that high could only be Magnus." "Ah, good. You're awake."
She tossed me a brown paper bag that smelled of garlic.
"Come on, time's wasting."
She led us to the main room, where her ceramic duality dude still lay in pieces. She circled the table, checking her work and nodding with satisfaction, though I couldn't see that anything had changed.
"Okay, yep, we're good."
I opened the paper bag and frowned.
"You left me a garlic bagel?"
"Last awake, last choice," Alex said.
"My breath is going to be terrible."
"More terrible," Alex corrected. "Well, that's fine. I'm not kissing you." "Are you kissing him, TJ?"
"Wasn't planning on it."
TJ popped the last of his bagel in his mouth and grinned.
I didn't say anything about," I stammered. "I didn't mean..."
My face felt like it was crawling with fire ants.
"Whatever. TJ, why are you wearing those glasses anyway?"
I'm good at subtly changing the conversation like that when I'm embarrassed. "It's a gift."
TJ wiggled his new specs. "You helped jog my memory, Magnus, talking about that sniper last night. Then I dreamed about Hrungnir and those weird amber eyes of his, and I saw myself laughing and shooting him dead. Then when I woke up, I remembered I had these in my haversack. Completely forgot about them."
It sounded like TJ had way better dreams than I did, which was no surprise.
"They're sniper glasses," he explained. "They're what we used before scopes were invented. I bought this pair in Valhalla, 100 years ago, I guess, so I'm pretty sure they're magic. Can't wait to try them out."
I doubted Hrungnir was going to stand while TJ sniped at him from a safe distance. I also doubted any of us would be doing much laughing today. But I didn't want to spoil TJ's pre-combat buzz. I turned to the ceramic warrior.
"So what's going on with Pottery Barn Guy? Why is he still in pieces?"
Alex beamed.
"Pottery Barn? Good name. But let's not assume Pottery Barn's gender."
Okay.
"Wish me luck."
She took a deep breath, then traced her fingers across the ceramic warrior's two faces. The ceramic pieces clattered and flew together as if they'd been magnetized. Pottery Barn sat up and focused on Alex. The faces were still hardened clay, but the frozen twin sneers suddenly seemed angrier, hungrier. The right side's eye sockets glowed with golden light.
"Yes!"
Alex exhaled with relief.
"Okay. Pottery Barn is non-binary, as I suspected. Preferred pronouns are they and them. And they are ready to fight."
Pottery Barn jumped off the table. Their limbs grinded and scraped like stones against cement. They stood about 8 feet tall, which was plenty scary to me. But I wondered if they stood a chance against whatever clay warrior Hrungnir had created. Pottery Barn must have sensed my doubt. They turned their faces toward me and raised their right fist. A heavy clay vase glazed blood red.
"Stop!"
Alex ordered.
"He's not the enemy."
Pottery Barn turned to Alex as if asking, "You sure about that?"
"Maybe they don't like garlic," Alex speculated. "Magnus, finish that bagel quickly and let's get on the road. We can't keep our enemies waiting."
Chapter 20.
Tvervigi equals worst Vigi. As we walked through the early morning streets of York, I ate my garlic bagel and told my friends about my dreams. Our new buddy Pottery Barn clanked along beside us, drawing disapproving looks from the sleepy locals, like, bah, tourists. At least my story kept TJ's attention, so he didn't pester too many Yorkshire folk with thank yous and handshakes. "Hmm," he said. "I wish I knew why we needed the whetstone. I think maybe Odin discussed the Bulwark incident in one of his books. The Aesir Path to Winning? Or was it The Art of the Steel? I can't remember the details. A big beast with green eyes, you say? And lots of teeth." I tried to shake off the memory. "Maybe Odin killed the beast to get the stone? Or maybe he hit the beast in the face with the stone, and that's how he got the mead?" TJ frowned. He'd propped his new glasses on the rim of his cap. "Neither sounds right. I don't remember any monster. I'm pretty sure Odin stole the mead from giants." I recalled my earlier dream of about Thialar and Gialar's chainsaw massacre. "But didn't dwarves kill Kvasir? How did giants get the mead?" TJ shrugged. "All the old stories are basically about one group murdering another group to steal their stuff. That's probably how." This made me proud to be a Viking. "Okay, but we don't have much time to figure it out. Those glaciers I saw are melting fast. Midsummer is in like 12 days now. But I think Loki's ship will be able to sail long before that." "Guys," Alex said, "how about this? First we beat the giant, then we talk about our next impossible task." That sounded sensible, though I suspected Alex just wanted me to shut up so I wouldn't breathe more garlic in her direction. "Anyone know where we're going?" I asked. "What's a Konungsgirtha?" "It means king's court," TJ said. "Was that in your travel book?" "No," TJ laughed. "Old Norse 101. Didn't you take that class yet?" "I had a scheduling conflict," I muttered. "Well, this is England. There's got to be a king with a court around here somewhere." Alex stopped at the next crossroads. She pointed to one of the signs.
"What about King's Square? Will that do?"
Pottery Barn seemed to think so. They turned their double faces in that direction and strode off. We followed, since it would have been irresponsible to let an 8-foot-tall pile of ceramics walk through town unaccompanied. We found the place. Hooray! King's Square wasn't a square, and it wasn't very kingly. The streets made a Y around a triangular park paved in gray slate, with some scrubby trees and a couple of park benches. The surrounding buildings were dark, the storefronts shuttered. The only soul in sight was the giant Hrungnir, his boots planted on either side of a pharmacy named, appropriately enough, Boots. The giant was dressed in his same quilted armor, his shaggy limestone beard freshly avalanched, his amber eyes bright with that can't-wait-to-kill-you gleam. His maul stood upright beside him, like the world's largest Festivus pole. When Hrungnir saw us, his mouth split in a grin that would have made masons and bricklayers' hearts flutter.
"Well, well, you showed up! I was beginning to think you'd run away."
He knit his gravelly eyebrows.
"Most people run away. It's very annoying."
"Can't imagine why," I said. Hrungnir nodded at Pottery Barn.
"That's your ceramic second, eh? Doesn't look like much."
"You just wait," Alex promised.
"I look forward to it,"
the giant boomed.
"I love killing people here. You know, long ago,"
he gestured toward a nearby pub,
"the Norse king of Jorvik's court stood right there. And where you are standing, the Christians had a church. See? You're walking on somebody's grave.
Sure enough, the slab of slate under my feet was etched with a name and dates too faded to read. The whole square was paved with tombstones, maybe from the floor of the old church. The idea of walking over so many dead people made me queasy, even though I was technically a dead person myself. The giant chuckled.
Seems fitting, doesn't it? Already so many dead humans here. What's a few more?
He faced TJ.
Are you ready?
Born ready, TJ said. Died ready. Resurrected ready. But I'm giving you one last chance, Hrungnir. It's not too late to opt for bingo.
Ha! No, little Enheryi. I worked all night on my fighting partner. I don't intend to waste him on bingo. Mokkerkalfe, get over here!
The ground shook with a squishy thump, thump. From around the corner appeared a man of clay. He was 9 feet tall, crudely shaped, still glistening wet. He looked like something I might make in Pottery 101. An ugly, lumpy creature with arms too thin and legs too thick. His head no more than a blob with two eye holes and a frowny face carved into it. Next to me, Pottery Barn started to clatter, and I didn't think it was from excitement. Bigger doesn't mean stronger, I told them under my breath. Pottery Barn turned their faces toward me. Of course, their expressions didn't change, but I sensed that both mouths were telling me the same thing. Shut up, Magnus. Alex crossed her arms. She'd tied her yellow raincoat around her waist, revealing the plaid pink and green sweater vest I thought of as her combat uniform.
You do sloppy work, Hrungnir. You call that a clay man? And what kind of name is Mokkerkalfe?
The giant raised his eyebrows.
We'll see whose work is sloppy when the fighting begins. Mokkerkalfe means mist calf, a poetic, honorable name for a warrior.
Uh-huh, Alex said. Well, this is Pottery Barn.
Hrungnir scratched his beard.
I must admit, that is also a poetic name for a warrior. But can it fight?
They can fight just fine, Alex promised. And they'll take down that slag heap of yours, no problem.
Pottery Barn looked at their creator like, I will.
Enough talk!
Hrungnir hefted his maul and scowled at TJ.
Shall we begin, little man?
Thomas Jefferson Jr. put on his amber-rimmed glasses. He unslung his rifle and pulled a small cylindrical paper packet, a gunpaper cartridge, from his kit.
This rifle has a poetic name, too, he said. It's a Springfield 1861, made in Massachusetts, just like me.
He tore open the cartridge with his teeth, then poured the contents into the rifle's muzzle. He pulled the ramrod and jammed down the powder and ball.
I used to be able to shoot 3 rounds a minute with this beauty, but I've been practicing for several hundred years. Let's see if I can do 5 rounds a minute today.
He fished out a little metal cap from his side pouch and set it under the hammer. I'd seen him do all this before, but the way he could load, talk, and walk at the same time was as magical as Alex's skill at the pottery wheel. For me, it would have been like trying to tie my shoes and whistle the Star-Spangled Banner while jogging.
Very well, yelled Hrungnir. Let the Tvervigi begin!
My first task was my favorite one, getting out of the way. I scrambled right as the giant's mallet slammed into a tree, smashing it to kindling. With a dry crack, TJ's rifle discharged. The giant roared in pain. He staggered backward, smoke streaming from his left eye, which was now black instead of amber.
That was rude!
Hrungnir raised his mallet again, but TJ circled to his blind side, calmly reloading.
His second shot sparked off the giant's nose. Meanwhile, Mokkerkalfa lumbered forward, swinging his tiny arms, but Pottery Barn was quicker. I wanted to credit the great work I'd done on their coil joints. PB ducked to one side and came up behind Mokkerkalfa, slamming both vase fists into his back. Unfortunately, their fists sank into Mokkerkalfa's soft, gooey flesh. As Mokkerkalfa turned, trying to face his opponent, PB got yanked off their feet and dragged around like a ceramic tail.
"Let go!" Alex yelled. "Pottery Barn! Oh, main fritter!"
She loosened her garrote, though how she could help without actually fighting, I wasn't sure.
Crack!
TJ's musket ball ricocheted off the giant's neck, shattering a second-story window. I was amazed the locals hadn't already come out to investigate the commotion. Maybe there was a strong glamour at work. Or maybe the good people of York were used to early morning Viking giant smackdowns. TJ reloaded as the giant pressed him back.
"Stand still, little mortal!" roared Hrungnir. "I want to smash you!"
King's Square was close quarters for a Jotun. TJ tried to stay on Hrungnir's blind side, but the giant only needed one well-timed step or one lucky swipe to flatten TJ into an infantry pancake. Hrungnir swung his maul again. TJ leaped aside just in time as the maul splintered a dozen tombstones, leaving a 10-feet-deep hole in the courtyard. Meanwhile, Alex lashed out with her wire. She lassoed Pottery Barn's legs and yanked them free. Unfortunately, she put a little too much muscle into it, just as Mokkerkalfa swung in the same direction. With the excessive momentum, Pottery Barn went flying across the square and smashed through the window of a store offering payday loans. Mokkerkalfa turned toward Alex. The clay man made a wet, gurgling sound in his chest, like the growl of a carnivorous toad.
"Whoa there, boy," Alex said. "I wasn't actually fighting. I'm not your..."
"Gurgle!"
Mokkerkalfa launched himself like a wrestler, more quickly than I would have thought possible, and Alex disappeared under 300 pounds of wet clay.
"No!"
I screamed. Before I could move or even process how to help Alex, TJ screamed at the other end of the courtyard.
"Ha!"
Hrungnir raised his fist. Wrapped in his fingers, struggling helplessly, was Thomas Jefferson Jr.
"One squeeze," the giant boasted, "and this contest is over."
I stood paralyzed. I wanted to break into two parts, to become a duality like our ceramic warrior. But even if I could, I didn't see how I could help either of my friends. Then the giant tightened his fist, and TJ howled in agony. Chapter 21 Fun with Open Heart Surgery. Pottery Barn saved the day. And no, that's not a line I ever thought I would use. Our ceramic friend exploded from a third-story window above the payday loan office. They hurled themselves onto Hrungnir's face, clamping their legs around the giant's upper lip and wailing his nose with both their vase fists.
"Bah! Get off!"
Hrungnir staggered, releasing TJ, who landed in an unmoving heap. Meanwhile, Mokkerkalfa struggled to get up, which must have been difficult with Alex Fierro imprinted on his chest. From beneath his weight, Alex groaned. Relief washed over me. At least she was alive and might stay that way for a few more seconds. Triage decision. I ran toward TJ, whose condition I wasn't so optimistic about. I knelt at his side, put my hand against his chest. I almost snatched my hand away again because the damage I sensed was so bad. A trickle of red etched the corner of his mouth like he'd been drinking Tizer, but I knew it wasn't Tizer. "Hang on, buddy," I muttered. "I got you."
I glanced over at Hrungnir, who was still stumbling around trying to grab Pottery Barn off his face. So far, so good. At the other side of the square, Mokkerkalfe had peeled himself away from Alex and now stood over her, gurgling angrily and pounding his bloody fists together. Not so good. I yanked the runestone from my neck chain and summoned Sumarbrander. "Jack!" I yelled.
"What?"
he yelled back.
"Defend Alex!"
"What?"
"But do it without actually fighting."
"What?"
"Just keep that clay giant off her."
"What?"
"Distract him! Go!"
I was glad he didn't say what again, or I would have worried that my sword was going deaf. Jack flew over to Mokkerkalfe, positioning himself between the clay man and Alex.
"Hey, buddy!"
Jack's runes pulsed up and down his blade like equalizer lights.
"You want to hear a story? A song? Want to dance?"
While Mokkerkalfe struggled to comprehend the strange hallucination he was having, I returned my attention to TJ. I put both hands against his sternum and summoned the power of Frey. Sunlight spread across the blue wool fibers of his jacket. Warmth sank into his chest, knitting his broken ribs, mending his punctured lungs, unflattening several internal organs that did not function well when they were flattened. As my healing power flowed into Thomas Jefferson Jr., his memories backwashed into my mind. I saw his mother in a faded gingham dress, her hair prematurely gray, her face stretched thin from years of hard work and worry. She knelt in front of 10-year-old TJ, her hands tightly clasping his shoulders as if she were afraid he might blow away in a storm.
"Don't you ever point that at a white man," she scolded.
"Ma, it's just a stick," TJ said. "I'm playing."
"You don't get to play," she snapped. "You play shoot at a white man with a stick, he's going to real shoot you back with a gun. I'm not losing another child, Thomas. You hear me?"
She shook him, trying to rattle the message into him. A different image, TJ as a teenager, reading a flyer posted on a brick wall by the wharf. "To colored men. Freedom. Protection, pay, and a call to military service." I could sense TJ's pulse racing. He had never been so excited. His hands itched to hold a rifle. He felt a calling, an undeniable impulse, like all those times he'd been challenged to fistfights in the alley behind his ma's tavern. This was a personal challenge, and he could not refuse it. I saw him in the hold of a Union ship, the seas pitching as his comrades threw up in buckets on either side of him. A friend of his, William H. Butler, groaned in misery.
"They bring our people over on slave ships. They free us. They promise to pay us to fight. Then they put us right back into the belly of a ship."
But TJ held his rifle eagerly, his heart pumping with excitement. He was proud of his uniform. Proud of those stars and stripes flapping on the mast somewhere over their heads. The Union had given him a real gun. They were paying him to shoot rebels. White men who would most definitely kill him given a chance. He grinned in the dark. Then I saw him running across no man's land at the Battle of Fort Wagner, gunsmoke rising like volcanic gas all around him. The air was thick with sulfur and the screams of the wounded, but TJ stayed focused on his nemesis, Geoffrey Toussaint, who had dared to call him out. TJ leveled his bayonet and charged, exhilarated by the sudden fear in Toussaint's eyes. Back in the present, TJ gasped. Behind his amber-rimmed glasses, his vision cleared. He croaked,
"My left, your right."
I dove to one side. I'll admit I didn't have time to distinguish left from right. I rolled onto my back as TJ raised his rifle and fired. Hrungnir, now free of Pottery Barn's affections, loomed over us, his maul raised for one final strike,
TJ's musket ball caught him in the right eye, snuffing out his sight.
Rarg!
Hrungnir dropped his weapon and sat down hard in the middle of King's Square, crushing two park benches under his ample butt. In a nearby tree, Pottery Barn hung broken and battered, their left leg dangling from a branch 10 feet above their head. But when they saw Hrungnir's predicament, they grinded their head against their neck with a sound like laughter.
Go!
TJ snapped me out of my shock. Help Alex! I scrambled to my feet and ran. Jack was still trying to entertain Mokkerkalfe, but his song and dance routine was wearing thin. That happens quickly with Jack. Mokkerkalfe tried to swat him aside. The blade got stuck on the back of the clay man's sticky hand.
Yuck!
Jack complained.
Let me go!
Jack was a little obsessive about cleanliness. After lying at the bottom of the Charles River for 1,000 years, he wasn't a fan of mud. As Mokkerkalfe stomped around, trying to dislodge the talking sword from his hand, I ran to Alex's side. She was spread-eagled, shellacked in clay from head to foot, groaning and twitching her fingers. I knew Alex didn't like my healing powers. She hated the idea of me peeking into her emotions and memories, which just happened automatically as part of the process. But I decided her survival outweighed her right to privacy. I clamped my hand on her shoulder. Golden light seeped through my fingers. Warmth poured into Alex's body, working its way from her shoulder into her core. I steeled myself for more painful images. I was ready to face her awful father again, or see how badly Alex had been bullied at school, or how she'd been beaten up in the homeless shelters. Instead, a single clear memory hit me. Nothing special. Just breakfast at Cafe 19 in Valhalla. A quick snapshot of me, stupid Magnus Chase, the way Alex saw me. I was sitting across the table from her, grinning at something she'd just said. A little glob of bread was stuck between my front teeth. My hair was messy. I looked relaxed and happy and utterly dorky. I held Alex's gaze for a second too long, and things got awkward. I blushed and looked away. That was her entire memory. I recalled that morning. I remember thinking at the time, well, I've made a complete idiot of myself, as usual. But it had hardly been an earth-shaking event. So why was it at the top of Alex's memories? And why did I feel such a rush of satisfaction seeing my dorky self from Alex's perspective? Alex opened her eyes abruptly. She swatted my hand off her shoulder.
Stop that. Sorry, my right, your left.
I dove one way. Alex rolled the other. Mokkerkalfe's fist, now free of Jack's blade, slammed into the slate pavement between us. I caught a glimpse of Jack, leaning in the doorway of the Boots Pharmacy, covered with mud and groaning like a dying soldier.
He got me! He got me!
The clay man rose, ready to kill us. Jack would be no help. Alex and I were not up to this fight. Then a pile of pottery hurtled out of nowhere and landed on Mokkerkalfe's back. Somehow, Pottery Barn had extricated themselves from the tree. Despite their missing left leg, despite their right vase hand being cracked to shards, Pottery Barn went into ceramic berserker overdrive. They ripped into Mokkerkalfe's back, gouging out chunks of wet clay as if excavating a collapsed well. Mokkerkalfe stumbled. He tried to grab Pottery Barn, but his arms were too short. Then, with a sucking pop, Pottery Barn pulled something from Mokkerkalfe's chest cavity, and both warriors collapsed. Mokkerkalfe steamed and began to melt. Pottery Barn rolled off their enemy's carcass, their double faces turning toward Alex. Weakly, they lifted the thing they were holding. When I realized what it was, my garlic bagel breakfast threatened to come back up again.
Pottery Barn was offering Alex the heart of their enemy. An actual heart muscle, much too big for a human. Maybe it had belonged to a horse or a cow? I decided I'd rather remain ignorant. Alex knelt by Pottery Barn's side. She placed her hand across the warrior's double foreheads. "You did well," she said, her voice quavering. "My Tlatilcan ancestors would be proud of you. My grandfather would be proud. Most of all, I'm proud." The gold light flickered in the skull face's eye sockets, then went out. Pottery Barn's arms collapsed. Their pieces lost magical cohesion and fell apart. Alex allowed herself the space of 3 heartbeats to grieve. I could count them.